Hello, this is Bob Dobbs, and it's November 1st, 2013. And we're doing part two in our conversation with Dennis Young. Dennis Young is the Professor Emeritus of Art History at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And this time we're going to pursue and analyze an article he wrote back in 2002, which was based on a talk he gave at Dalhousie University on a painting conference. Dennis, what was the occasion for this?
Yes, it was a citywide display of paintings, and all the museums in the city took part in it. And I was invited to give a lecture on painting. I more or less pushed my way in because I thought, I'm certain that everything that you see or hear in this lecture, it was new to everyone in the city. I mean, no one is being taught this stuff. It doesn't matter whether they're being taught medieval art or classical art or whatever. The stuff in this lecture is simply not there. Of course, even if it were there, it wouldn't be as coherent and as self-reflexive as it is here. I mean, I move, as I say in the introduction, back and forth between the present and the past. So I gave the lecture at Dalhousie University, and it was very well received, of course, and that was why it got published by the NASCAD Press. They then had some kind of journal going. They don't have it going anymore.
When I read it, it struck me, and it's called, I don't know if I gave the title, Painting and Its Paradigms. And you can Google that. Technically, it's at dennis-young.ca, dennis-young.ca. Dennis Young's collections on his writings on art. It's made up of facts, but it seems different. It seems new. It seems unique, what you're saying. That's why I thought it's best to go into it and talk about it. Is there no statement like what you make here in anything in art history?
I don't think any of this stuff is taught. It's certainly not taught in the way this lecture was prepared. In fact, the lecture was prepared from skimming stuff off two or three lectures in a full course that I gave while I was still teaching. That would have been something like 12 years earlier than the writing of this lecture when I retired. I taught a course that had various names, but it was basically Art in the History of Ideas, based on the famous History of Ideas and its journal. You'll see that I quote or I mention in the notes the Journal of the History of Ideas of October 1951, when Paul Oscar Christella published a tremendous article on the modern system of the arts, which to some degree underlies this paper.
The opening theme, I noticed Picasso was aware of it because you have a quote from Picasso. What's interesting example is that George Bull, you reference a book by him in 1965, the Penguin Classics edition, and he has to be corrected over the terms inspired genius.
What I didn't say was that he was a classmate of mine.
Ah, this is what we hope to get in this, the extras that were left out off the speech.
He was more a linguist than he was an art historian, and I think he got special permission to joined classes that I was taking then, and it would have been 1953, 54, something like that.
Okay, so let's start off this lecture. You make the point that art, what we call art today, was not an intellectual process. It's not what Tom Wolfe wrote in the 70s, The Painted Word, where the theory is illustrated by the painting or the art. Remember that book, The Painted Word?
Yeah.
Art was a craft. At best, it was a lowly activity. At best, it was considered.
Yes, what I tried to point out in the course, in much more detail, of course, was that handworkers were not considered to be classy or anything whatsoever. They were lucky if they got paid. It was intellectual workers who worked with their heads, who read and wrote for most of the time in Latin. They had the superior caste in the arts, and people who made the art were ignored as people. There was a moment in Greek history when they were recognized a little better, but it didn't really come to very much.
Then you have the Dark Ages.
Right. And suddenly out of the Dark Ages appeared the guilds. what happened during the Dark Ages was, of course, during the classical period, you didn't have the Christian church. And what had happened in the 1,000 years between the end of Rome and the Middle Ages, approximately 1,000 years anyway,
right,
was that the church had created a sort of schism between the ordinary people of any nation and the clerisy, because the clerisy could communicate in the international language. Latin in those days, of course, was what British English is today. And it was very difficult for people who hadn't been schooled.
Yes.
So this is why, of course, the first schools began. There was a lack of people to join in the Latin discourse. And I don't know whether I mentioned this to you, but the school that I attended is classed as the 20th school in Britain to be created. That was in 1379.
What's the name of the school?
Wisbeach Grammar School.
Wisbeach.
Plus the grammar that you were supposed to learn in 1376 or 79 was Latin. They might have taught a bit of mathematics, of course, because during the Middle Ages, thinking individuals were constantly composing theories about this, that, and the other, and basing a lot of what they did on numerology. So during that period of the Middle Ages, you had the artes liberales and the artes serviles, the servile arts. And I should mention, before we get too confused, that the word arts meant in those days skill.
Right.
It didn't mean how we use it today. Although I think it's quite clear, as I say in the piece, that the reason why we use it today is that it was the way in which the literate people during the Middle Ages used the word skill. And gradually, as competition ensued from those people who were the servile individuals, who were given 7 mechanical arts as a privilege. And those mechanical arts were something like weaving, plowing, architecture even got in. Imagine the difference between plowing and an architecture. Armory, trading, blacksmithing, and even cooking. So we can see from the history of the art that where architecture was concerned, the architects were already well planning to get out of that and to get themselves into the liberal arts, which were the arts of arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, music, grammar, rhetoric, and logic.
Now, I have in my notes to summarize what you've said. Art was a craft and applied to things like saddle making. And in your article, you say these were the mechanical arts. You have that in quotes, but you don't list the mechanical arts. So you just did that. So that's useful. And then I've got here, theologians, philosophers, and poets spoke in Latin, engaged the 7 liberal arts, which you just listed. And they were known as the trivium and quadrivium, the 7 liberal arts. And they didn't want to be associated with work by hand because they worked with their heads. And the aesthetic of the time was not beauty, the people, or some sociological message. The aesthetic was communion with God, cosmic proportions of the universe, and goodness and moral harmony, and maybe Plato's divine light, not the hedonistic pleasure of embellished objects.
Yes, that's true.
That's what you write. And that's a major distinction for people today who begin with the hedonistic pleasure of embellished objects and then into all the different schools of abstraction. But that is nowhere near, because the craftsmen at that time weren't educated enough to come up with concepts like we started doing a couple hundred years ago, right?
Yeah. I think I mentioned somewhere that when the guilds began, and that was after the formation of the earlier cities, of course. So we're looking at the 11th and 12th centuries,
right,
when the guilds began. But the guilds were an effort for municipal government to keep some control and some fairness and so on. Of course, in a way, each guild wanted to rule its people and to run at what today we would call a closed shop, which it was very difficult to get into. So if you wanted to be an architect, for instance, it would have been very difficult. You'd face lots of problems. And almost certainly you'd have to work your way up through earliest of the ranks, which would be apprentice. And then once you'd finish your 7 years, this seven crops up enormously, of course, 7 days in the week and all the rest. 7 years as an apprentice. And if you could persuade the master of your guild that you deserved it, you'd become a journeyman then, which would mean you were qualified to execute works, but you weren't qualified to dominate the creation of them. For that, you'd have to work on your masterpiece. That's where we get the word masterpiece today, of course, from that medieval period in which to qualify as a person who could invent and create, you had to persuade the master of the guild, and maybe even a little committee of people in the guild, that you were equal to it.
Now, the change comes with a person named Cennini. And about 1400, he writes this booklet, The Craftsman's Handbook. It's the fact that he writes a book about these guys saying, hey, this is an actual occupation known as painting. That was radical, wasn't it? To make these people worth writing about. Is that what changes with Cennini?
Yes, it's a signal that things are changing. But this was 1400. It wasn't 1200. In 1400, many of the cities of Europe looked like really serious cities. I mean, they had churches and large buildings and paved streets and so on. There were lots of opportunities that didn't exist in, let's say, the year 10,000.
You mean 1,000? Not 10,000, 1,000.
Yeah, 1,000, yes. 1,000, yeah.
And it's after the plague. It's a recovery after the plague. If it's 1,400, the plague is 1348, I think.
One thing that happened during the plagues, of course, it's very important, was that it simply took away maybe a whole guild out of the city. We're all dead. You had to somehow accommodate or invent a new method, perhaps. I'm not sure whether it's true to say that methods to become a master actually changed then. In England, certainly, King John, and that was well before the year 1400.
Yeah, it's 1200, it's King John.
Yes, I mean, King John issued letters patent to some of the Huguenot refugees from France who were weavers. In doing that, he had sort of done an end run around the guilds. So the guilds were very offended, and there became two kinds of master. One was the master who'd gone through the guild system, and the other would be the master who had what were called at the time letters patent from the king.
Right.
So God knows whether he wrote them, you know.
Well, with Cennini, C-E-N-N-I-N-I, Cennini.
Yes, that's right.
He brings in three themes. He says, preposterously, the idea of imagination might be involved in painting. There might be individual style and copying from nature. And the important point you make is painting was to make visible the invisible. That was the revolutionary, to emphasize what was seen. Because a lot of the, I guess, abstraction by the intellectual elite, the literate guys thinking and writing in Latin, was about the invisible world.
Yes, it was. And of course, to be able to do that, whether it was possible or not, is another matter. But to say that it could be done gave them some status. It was a way of giving painters a bit more status in general. Though it is true to say that in the years before Cennini wrote, and perhaps because he wrote, I mean, why would you write? There was no printing at the time. So you would write and have to have your books copied. Why would he write unless he thought there would be some reliable reception from the art community? Let's break the rule and use the word art. Or from the craft community. So he wrote his book. But most of the book was a practical book. Most of it was to tell them how to prepare the surfaces, what materials to use, how to grind paint, how to mix paint, and so on.
So the metaphysical statement is simply to discover things not seen, hiding themselves under the shadow of natural objects, is the quote you have.
Yes.
And you have to make the unseen visible. But they're still dealing with the unseen, but they want to make it visible. And you say this is a statement about the noumenal or spiritual.
People in those days were very credulous. people were credulous till the end of the 18th century and the 19th century, and there are plenty of credulous people in America today.
If you could say something with some concepts in it, people would be stunned by it. They'd believe it.
They were primed to believe it by the church, who really had educated them in the idea that the deity was invisible, but you could get close to him by drinking the blood and eating the flesh of Christ in the Mass. Every week, the faithful would be invited to go up to the local church. And my goodness, in Britain, there were churches all over the place. I mean, it's amazing in Norfolk, where I come from, how many churches there are. Mm. And of course, today, they're all languishing without anyone.
Empty, yeah.
Empty, and ultimately, of course, they're going to get so weathered that they'll be dangerous. But in those days, the stonemasons were incredibly good, and the way they built the churches was not for an age, but for all time, so to speak. They do survive. It's a great pity somehow that they're not kept up.
Yeah. Okay, so here's what's interesting. So Cennini's in 1400, but within 35 years, a radical change happens. Brunelleschi and Alberti, well, Brunelleschi invents monocular perspective, or the peephole, as you say, and then Alberti writes the book about this, and this moves things away from painting the invisible to painting what the eye can see within the pyramid of the perspective.
That was a remarkable intellectual achievement to conceive how perspective could create a convincing space, and that the picture surface could be treated as a window that you looked through. That was amazing. In fact, I was in Italy about 9 years ago in Florence, and I said to myself, I have to see the first great work of perspective that was ever done. It was done by a friend of Brunelleschi's. It represented the Trinity. I went along to the church, and looking for it, I mean, I must have seen it years before, but I couldn't have remembered actually its place. Looking for it, I discovered that it was on a blank wall. Nothing else was on that wall. That may be something to do with honoring the achievement. It was stuck on like a postage stamp, like a huge postage stamp, maybe 10 feet high and 6 or 7 feet wide. I stood across the church from it, looking at it, and what I saw was the crucifixion with God the Father above the crucified Christ, and on each side, the image of the individuals in Florence that had sponsored and paid for it. Mm-hmm. But below it, I saw what I thought was a tomb in three dimensions. It was as if somebody had been buried in this tomb, and above it, this image had been made.
Is the tomb part of the image?
Well, I thought, this is incredible, you know. So there's a tomb below this. I can see it's a tomb. So I walked over to it. It's difficult to believe this, but that tomb was painted on the wall. It was not a three-dimensional tomb at all. So a painter had accomplished the most extraordinary result from learning from Brunelleschi how to do it. Just absolutely an astonishing piece. And it's good to see it's still there, very well preserved.
Where is it?
Oh, it's in Florence, yes.
Oh, it's in Florence.
It's in one of the large churches in the city, near the main railway station, actually.
Okay, well, Alberti writes a book called Della Pittura, or About Pictures. And this was the formula that would be laid out and would rule for many centuries. So that the painting the invisible was dropped, and now the fascination of what you write is it's almost positivist or Aristotelian. Painting the visible and working with perspective is the big challenge and the big accomplishment. And also Alberti brings in the idea of the learned painter. That was radical. And then Medici and the Florentine Academy had to make the painters learned, right? So they started a school. At the beginning, under Alberti's influence of his text, which comes out in 1435, and perspective becomes the new challenge, and artists start doing that. But Alberti also brings in the notion of the learned painter.
Yes, that's
all right. So
yes.
Then they had to have a school to make the learned painter, and that's when the Medicis, or the singular Medici, whoever, created the Florentine Academy.
I'm not sure exactly how it goes.
You say Michelangelo and Botticelli influenced the Medicis.
But I have a suspicion that they were embracing Plotinus.
That's right.
And some slightly more occult bits of then Christian religion.
You even make the point that Copernicus makes it a heliocentric universe, but at the core of it is the cult of sun worship. This is why he's emphasizing the sun. This occult concept or doctrine of Neoplatonism is embedded in the major scientific paradigm.
Even Newton, you know, believed in witches.
Yes, that's right.
And we're talking, for Newton, we're talking about another couple of centuries on, the guy who invented calculus and so on.
His manuscript was purchased by John Maynard Keynes, the guy who justified the welfare state in the 30s, you know, the British economist.
Uh-huh.
He purchased Newton's papers in the maybe late 60s, early 70s, and discovered the majority was Newton trying to figure out the Book of Revelation.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Everybody was into the Bible. That was the first book published, and they were trying to figure it out. It just hadn't got to the mechanical sciences yet. So Newton was, like anybody else, thinking about the end times, what was going to happen.
The more you read history, the more astonished you are to find what was in the heads of people and also what was in the environment in which they lived. In the 1600s, Louis XIV built Versailles, the biggest single palace in the world, as far as I know, for which he had commandeered all the gold in France or something. If you read about the social history of that time and what it was like to actually be in the Louvre stank. People urinated against the wall in the full view of anybody else inside the place.
This is the big palace you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, this is the huge palace. Yes. And they defecated, too, from time to time around a corner. I don't know enough about it to know just how many people were supposed to pick up the or mop up what they left behind, but it was just acceptable. Erasmus wrote a tract on decorum in everyday life, if you like. I'm not sure what the title of it actually was, but it's about decorum. He advised you to turn away and use cloth when you blow your nose. Wash your hands before a meal. Now, of course, there was no soap. A page boy would come and pour water over your hands. Don't dip your bread into sauce if you've taken a bite out of it, you know. But with Voltaire, who also wrote an essay sur les mœurs, essay on manners, just got a note here, wrote, don't relieve yourself in front of others. Don't do up your clothes in front of others. Wash your hands before retiring. Don't foul the stairs with urine. Don't greet someone who is urinating or defecating. So, I mean, you could walk along some palatial place and find somebody defecating.
Would that be in the king's quarters, even?
Well, I'm not sure about that because he wasn't that popular with the monarch in those days. In fact, as you may know, he lived most of his life on the border with Switzerland. He had what today we would call a castle, I guess. I've never visited it, but he had a castle in France, and he had a castle across the border in Switzerland. And he had scouts whose duty it was to check people coming along the road in his direction. I mean, they could tell pretty well if it was someone important. And generally, if it was someone important, he would skedaddle into Switzerland.
Right, this is Voltaire. I was saying, not did he get to defecate in the Louis XIV's palace, but could anybody in the king's quarters, will only be the court people, could they do this bathroom activity in front of the king in his area, or is the Louvre was just like a warehouse?
One of my friends was an expert on that period, an historian. We were discussing this a few years ago, I recall. He said that when Louis XIV wanted to defecate, he did it surrounded by courtiers who probably applauded or something. But he would order chaise penetre, which means chair with a hole in it. And a couple of guys, I guess, would bring it. He would pose on it and do his business.
Okay. So let's just go back a bit. The Medici's, the first academy, or the first school, the first official Florentine academy is not made until 1563. But back in 1457, they had some kind of classroom started where, with the new books brought from the collapse of the Byzantine Empire, I guess it would be, the Greek scholars were brought over to Florence, and they brought all the ancient texts, and that's 1457, and there was a great emphasis on Plato via Neoplatonism. So they were looking at the beauty of the unseen, the cosmic proportions of the unseen. But that doesn't last long. It seems that Leonardo, he supports Alberti, and supporting the monarchs bestowing master status with the letters patent. And so they move into the positivist or developing perspective and painting, and the Neoplatonism doesn't last long. It moves to the trend that Alberti started, thanks to Leonardo.
Yes. I have a feeling that Savonarola had something to do with the fact that it didn't last long.
He's the one who did the police state or something, right?
Yes, that's right, and burned a lot of books and goodness knows what. And probably those who were really seriously concerned fled to be out of Florence and to get some safety somewhere. That may be one of the ways in which the Neoplatonist movement disappeared or got dissipated in
right.
some way.
Savonarola wasn't a mystic. He was a practical tyrant, I guess you'd say. He was into controlling what you could see and to limited to what you could see. In general, then, the invisible is no longer painted, but perspective and all that implied, what you could see and, your talent in creating perspective started to rule the day. And this academy, the official one in 1563, it says, thanks to Michelangelo and Vasari, who wrote the lives, not of the artists, but the lives of the painters, is it?
Lives of the painters, sculptors, and...
Yeah, the painter, the sculptor, and the architect. That's the three lowly arts.
Yes.
Okay, so he writes the lives of the most eminent painters, sculptors, and architects, not the lives of the artists. And later, is it George Bull who calls it lives of the artists?
Yes, and it's common. I don't know how many other people had done that before George Bull, but certainly Vasari had been translated before Bull.
He did Vasari. You point out how he mixes up inspired genius with divine talent. Those terms refers to the three noble crafts. That's what the tre nobilis arti
is.
That's translated by Bull as three fine arts, which is the incorrect translation. They're not arts.
Yes, it is incorrect.
So the point is, what you're teaching here, making the point, is that the whole idea of art does not exist for a long time. It is just craft. But with the school, Michelangelo and Leonardo are starting to have this influence, the artists start to get educated, and they bring some of the liberal arts into their education, especially geometry and optics. What's very interesting is that by 1610, they even bring in Galileo to teach in the art school.
I don't know about teaching the art school, but at least enjoy the company of mathematicians who I assume were there.
Whereas they would never be around craftsmen before. But now the mathematicians, geometricians, and that are there. And I guess optics would be the teaching of perspective and whatever advanced version of that they developed by then, right?
Yes, I'm not sure how much advanced it is. It gets to be much more advanced in the 17th century. In fact, biggest challenges occur as more of the architecture of Rome is borrowed. It's interesting to remember that, let's say, around 1400 or so, it was usual to speak about the modern period or the modern style. The modern style was Gothic, not classical. So it's a little bit twisted. Most of us regard the sudden appearance of classical frontages. For instance, Alberti himself was an architect. He was in lots of things. He was sometimes known as the universal man. And a number of churches in the area of Florence, he changed the facade from a Gothic facade to what's later to be called Renaissance facade.
Which is a retrieval of Greek and Roman classical architecture.
Yes, he and others had spent a lot of time in Rome and measured the relationship of height and length and breadth and all the rest of it in Roman building. So a lot was known of how the Romans behaved. For reasons which are not clear really to me, everybody started to borrow these classical references. And the Gothic period really was over.
And that was that was called the modern period, the Gothic.
Yes, it was in its time.
Well, I remember reading about, in the competing schools of thought, the logicians and dialecticians, part of the trivium, would be contrary to the rhetoricians and grammarians. And generally, the rhetoricians and grammarians were considered the ancients, and the new guys, I guess the guys counting the number of angels on the head of a pin, the scholastics, were called the moderni, M-O-D-E-R-N-I. So they actually were called modern people in the 1300s. That
yes.
may be where it came from.
Of course, in a way, the Renaissance was a rebirth. So you didn't call it modern, you called it the rebirth or borrowing from the classical period.
They thought that was the more genuine, the more authentic art.
Exactly. But in fact, of course, it took over and it became what we might call imperial art. Every little mafiosa duke had to have his Renaissance castle.
He had to have his little temple.
So it spread over the whole of Europe, and it was much later on when Europe or Europeans became sensible to the distinctions between them. There was a sort of hostility towards the way that architecture had spread. Some of them preached separation from the southern and Mediterranean styles, especially in the north, in Sweden, Denmark, Finland, northern Germany, and so on.
Well, that would be partly the Protestant versus the Catholic.
Yes, there was a Gothic revival even, of course, in Britain, and especially in Germany. And we have the famous German writer Goethe saying that the new cathedral that was being built in Cologne, which was being built as a copy of Gothic cathedrals, was the true German art. Of course, Goethe was one of the people who belonged to a little group called the Sturm und Stress group.
That's Sturm und Drang?
Sturm und Drang, yes.
Yeah.
Germany in Goethe's time, towards the end of the 1700s, really an area with about 300 principalities and dukedoms of different sizes. Suddenly you had people like Goethe and Herder, his friend, and of course Beethoven a bit later, speaking about what was common to German and what you owed to Germany. In a certain sense, what happened was they were in luck when Napoleon invaded and abolished about 270 of these 300 principalities. When Napoleon had finished reorganizing Germany, there were only 30 principalities. That had made a big difference. And Germany and German intellectuals could see what was needed was a true Germany with one border, as you had with the Slavs in Russia. And with the Nordic peoples, you had this drive to consolidate on the basis of the languages. And so the Brothers Grimm, for instance, who people think simply wrote fairy tales, in fact, their profession was philology, and they wrote the first great German dictionary. And it was while they were traveling the German states to write this dictionary that they came across fairy tales and so on. And so you've got Grimm's fairy tales as a...
It was given back to them by the people. They collected them inadvertently. It was just dumped on them, these stories, right, while they were teaching philology.
Yes, as they traveled around, they picked them up, got interested in them, and finally published them. But that was not...
main activity. We were talking about the dukedoms, and everybody had the little palace. And what I think of is Ezra Pound's Cantos. He writes a lot about that period in the Cantos and the different famous dukes of the day that created little renaissance. It seems that Pound was all for this retrieval of classical stuff. Was it called classical back then? Or is that what the historians called? Did they say, okay, we're doing classical architecture here. We're retrieving Greece and Rome. I mean, do you think it was called classical?
Yes, I think they did. When they were building it, they were very aware of, I mean, particularly the history of Rome, but also the Greeks, had been enormously enhanced by the 19th century, which is what we're really talking about, when all this stuff went up. And then finally, there was a rebellion, so to speak, among the cognoscenti of Europe, who said, well, let the French and let the Swiss and the Italians and the Austrians keep their classical work, but we're going to stop and we're going to have a Gothic revival here.
Is that only in England?
No, it's certainly in Germany.
Germany and England do what we think of as Pre-Raphaelitism, the retrieval of the Gothic.
I'm not sure we should mix the Pre-Raphs with the Gothic revival. We should just be careful to remember that the architecture they created and the work that they did might be assimilated to the Gothic revival. You couldn't perhaps escape it. But I don't think they were principal workers to create the Gothic revival. Gothic revival had already come.
Was that linked to nationalism, to Goethe's national movement, the Gothic revival?
I don't know enough about the ecclesiastical quarrels that went on in Britain during the 19th century, but certainly there was a division in the Christian church in the 19th century, a lot of tension between Catholics and Protestants, and which side voted for which isn't clear to me.
Are you saying that Goethe and Herder in Germany retrieved the Gothic as part of the Uniting Germany nationalist movement?
Yes, I mean, exactly.
I see. So that the dukedoms, the decentralized little tin pot kingdoms all over the place, were run by Latin princes and Latin scholars and had been retrieving Greece and Rome. That was the trend. That's the international culture.
The last great effort at that was Frederick the Great in Potsdam, which is a perfect neoclassic city.
So going back to your article and working through the linear stages you provide, we've now got art, and the big doctrine that comes in for the academies is ut pictura poesis.
Ut pictura poesis, yes.
Which means as painting, so poetry. You have the painters trying to get on the level of the literate poets. And so they absorb poetry with this phrase, as painting, so poetry, right?
Yes, and for that, you have to go back to the classical period and to the writings of the classical period that were sort of appearing, because that phrase is a phrase from the beginning of a treatise by the Roman poet Horace. That's what he says at the beginning, as painting, so poetry. He's working on a theory that will unite the two. One of the things that Horace emphasized was that the aim of poets and painters should be instruction and delight, which is a convincing sort of argument, isn't it? That what your poets and your painters should be patriotic, but they should not be dull. So what you have is instruction and delight, and this was borrowed as the Renaissance and post-Renaissance academies were formed. And it became the sort of motto over their doors, so to speak.
Well, let me run through the five precepts. This is what I wanted to get into. Okay, now they're learned painters, and they're starting to get a bit of social status and starting to create, not art yet. They're still not doing art. They're doing craft. They bring these five precepts, but they're restrictions. You had to paint this way. There was no individual invention or originality. These were the five laws, right?
Yes.
And the first one is instruction and delight, which is the highest level, and it's history painting. So I just read a note from your article. History painting lasted for 200 years until undermined after Louis XIV by Watteau, who started to paint hedonistic and erotically indulgent paintings. And another guy named Boucher, who you have says did the create the divertissement theory in the Rococo period. Okay, so that's what's coming. But you have 200 years, you've got to do history painting if you want to be a top painter. And then, the second point, you've got to imitate classical models. You have to imitate ancient sculptures.
By then, a lot of classical sculpture had been discovered and unearthed and dug up and so on. The Grand Tour for wealthy young people began roughly in the late 1600s and through the 1700s, everybody visited Pompeii and Herculaneum and so on. These places and others began to collect the remains of sculptures and so on that had been dug up there.
So it was the new novelty, sculpture. It was a novelty to have these ancient things be seen again. That's why it became a model.
It wasn't unknown, of course. I mean, I don't think we had to wait till the 18th century when Herculaneum and so on became popular tourist places. I mean, if you lived in Florence, there were relics. If you lived in Rome, there are a lot of relics. So you could use classical models for the work that you did, especially in sculpture, I guess. But the classics never really mastered perspective, so you didn't get very far with that.
What you point out is that the tradition of sitting for a portrait came from imitating sculptures. Is that what you're saying?
The sculptures that in many cases were unearthed and came on display were images of the so-called gods. Apollo was very common. So when you painted the king, you flattered him by painting him in the pose of a classical sculpture of Apollo. I mean, it's as simple as that. You clothed him rather more fully than Apollo would have been clothed, but apart from that.
What were you saying about the gathering of the gold? Do you remember that point?
Louis XIV
gathered the gold to make the palace, right?
To make furniture and God knows what for his palace, yeah.
Okay, so rule two is imitation of classical models, ancient sculptures. Rule three is what was called invention. Do you want to speak about that and the great chain of being?
I think the two should be looked upon separately. The great chain of being was something that had existed for 1,000 years. It was a piece of cosmology. That's the only way the ancients and even the Gothic period could imagine the universe to be constructed. It really meant that everything in the universe had its place on a ladder. The very highest rung of the ladder, of course, was the deity, and the very lowest rung of the ladder was probably the devil, for all I know. But in between, you had classes of things. For instance, animals were higher up than stones and boulders.
Yeah, you have landscapes.
Yes, I mean, how did it go? Something like earth, stones and boulders and things like that. Water somewhere in it there. And then you had trees and plants. Then you had animals. Each of these species had its own sort of king, if you like. For instance, the lion was always at the top of the animal kingdom. I don't know what was at the top of the vegetable kingdom, but this is why the lion image was adopted by so many monarchs when it came to the human race.
Now, Alberti and them started to say, you have to paint from the Bible and paint stories, maybe mythology. That was the beginning of the learned painter.
You had to know some mythology, you had to know some biblical tales, yes.
Right. So in this third rule of invention, I have my notes, only classical themes, no eccentric inspiration, and the academies for this reason create an actual hierarchy of subjects based on the antiquated notion of the great chain of being, so that antique stories or history paintings were at the top of the painterly chain of being. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were the top, and along with portraits of the monarch. Then portraits of the nobility, often with poses taken from classical sculpture, then animal paintings, then landscape paintings, because trees were lower in the great chain than animals, then still life paintings, and finally genre or low-life paintings not fit to be seen in a palace. That would be people? Low-life would be people?
People mostly in taverns, half drunk and so on. Pretty vulgar stuff. Of course, there was vulgar stuff around in literature, too, Rabelais and so on. But they weren't candidates for the top of the great chain of being.
That's why Rembrandt was a radical revolutionary when he started doing portraits of people. That was like Andy Warhol in a soup can.
There's a famous conversation that took place between Picasso and Kahnweiler, his dealer, which Kahnweiler published sometime just before the Second World War.
I have the quote here if you want me to read it.
Really? Is it in my script?
Yeah, it's in your notes. You have Picasso's dealer, Daniel Henry Kahnweiler, or is it Kahnweiler? You say the W with the V?
Yes, Kahnweiler.
Kahnweiler. in a book called Six Conversations with Picasso, 1956. Picasso says, people ought to know that artists of earlier times were artisans, and that it's only today that they are free to be artists. I said to Francois Gillot that the setback suffered by Rembrandt came from the fact that he'd wanted to be more than an artisan, that one ordered a portrait by him, and what one got in the end was a study of light and shadow or even of psychology, but not a recognizable portrait. That's why he got in trouble. And then he says, and I added that to his conversation with Gillot, that such a commission required the artist or artisan to have an end in sight that excluded perpetual creativity. You had to fit into the themes. Now, Picasso was aware of the point you're making in your article, but people didn't know it. Picasso's point here didn't get widely known.
Yes, that's amazing, isn't it? I should come across that. I think it's little known because, as I said, this little book was, I can't believe it had more than 40 pages in it. And these little conversations that they'd had were really, I guess, reminiscences by Kahnweiler. Actually, when he said them, isn't clear. But the fact that he should have said that at all is fascinating.
You have at the beginning of this note, note number three, quote, it may be added that though Michelangelo was a poet of distinction, the rise in status of painters, this is due to the Academy in 1560s, the rise in status of painters in general was impeded by their lack of literary education to the extent that in the 18th century, the encyclopedist Jean-Francois Marmontel, in his memoirs, recalls avoiding literary talk in the presence of painters for fear of embarrassing them. And that's in the 18th century, so it's a long, slow change that's going on. But we're at the point here where, shall I read the story of Veronese and the Last Supper?
If you'd like to read it, sure.
Yeah. He was brought before a tribunal of the Inquisition in Venice for being over-inventive in his portrayal of the Last Supper. He not only pleaded that painters had been granted the same license as poets, but when ordered nevertheless to alter the work, he avoided doing so by changing his title to Christ in the House of Levi.
That's amazing, isn't it? When you think of the possible consequences of defying those people who had the, I guess, the power to bring you before the Inquisition and put you on the rack or something. It's a kind of comment on the status that he had by then.
This is painting for courts. So if we thought of movies were made for rich people, you know, 100 years ago, but the rich people could not be insulted. This is the exact thing. They had a committee to determine what the movie was about. This is what's happening, you know, 400 years earlier, 300 years earlier. And painting was the new entertainment technology, and they had to really control the content. It's pretty interesting how everything has to be kept in such order. You actually made a different kind of painting, violating the rules. You had put a drug in the water reservoir, so to speak. You know
what I mean? Exactly. I mean, what we have to remember is that a great painting or a great stained glass window or something of that kind, and of course an imposing Gothic or an imposing Renaissance piece of architecture, they were the only things that the population had to be overawed by. Well, maybe a parade of the local duke or some of the army people with their flags and so on. But apart from that, a really great piece of painting, and particularly in the churches, the stained glass, it was like going to a flat-screen TV.
And the people are largely oral. Their culture was singing, dancing, and screwing, right?
Oh, very much. Yes, very much.
Partying. Visuality was a major technology, a major experience.
I don't know enough about the holidays that were available, but the church was responsible for lots of special days during the year. I mean, we celebrate, Christmas, Easter, and really that's about it.
Yeah.
But there were many saints' days, many days, therefore, when you didn't do a whole day's work or perhaps none at all, where you could, if you could afford it, get a pint of ale or something or more.
Right, it was like the church knew they had to let off steam a lot.
They let off steam to the point where there was a process once a year in some places called the Monarch of Misrule. Some farmer or some laborer or somebody from a pub would sort of take over the King's Role. They would have a lot of fun, presumably, with that. I don't know enough about it to say more. But there was a lot of person-to-person relationship and entertainment. Even in the cities, the churches would have congregations that knew each other. And, of course, in these small towns and villages, that would be also true. So that you would know the people with whom you frolicked. And who knows how many children from the local dignitaries would join you.
Okay, so this is theme three, rule three. This is what invention was, totally controlled, stick to the motifs, to the themes, and don't come up with your own thing. That was what invention was called. Okay, so then the fourth rule was decorum. Shall I read your notes here?
Yes, by all means.
The fourth rule, that of decorum, forbade excesses, exaggerations, and repulsive scenes, and required that every gesture of limb and drapery be appropriate to the purpose of the story portrayed. Horace, in The Art of Poetry, had insisted on similar limits, though his examples seem odd. For instance, he warned against joining a human head to a horse's neck or spreading varicolored plumage over the limbs of animals. All of it sounds like a tract against 20th century surrealist imagery. After all, the so-called, quote, surrealist marvelous was supposed to come exactly from the chance encounter of such incompatible things. However, although the concept of decorum had been elaborated more subtly by Leonardo, its testing began early. Then you say, think, for instance, of the controversy over the nudity in Michelangelo's Last Judgment or Caravaggio's painting St. Matthew with dirty feet. But this concept of decorum was eroded slowly and was continuous. According to Walter Benjamin, as late, or is it Walter Benjamin? How do you say Walter Benjamin?
Well, Benjamin, I don't, it depends whether you're just pronouncing it in the English fashion.
So, according to Walter Benjamin, as late as 1830, Da Vinci's translation of Othello failed because it was unacceptable for a handkerchief to figure in a tragedy.
Yes, that's incredible, isn't it?
The rules. We are such flooded with imagery in the 20th century that this is absurd, but the idea that an imagery could just knock someone out like a drug, that they had to control the imagery so that people could handle the technology.
I'm not sure, you know, exactly why that piece of decorum should have been. It's probably something to do, you know, with the intimate relations between producers and directors of the theater, more than it's to do with a sort of laughter that might come up over the handkerchief. I mean, after all, Shakespeare was greatly admired across Europe by then.
I read that he was nowhere for 200 years. He was retrieved by Goethe or somebody, or I can't remember Wordsworth, I don't remember who. His plays weren't performed for a couple hundred years. Did you know that?
Yes, all his works were translated in the early 1800s by a German.
Yes, Shakespeare was not continuous from 1600 or, say, 1650 to 1750. You know, gone.
Indeed, yes.
So decorum, let's say you have a note here. Da Vinci was still alive to see Baudelaire. You know, Da Vinci, his translation of Othello got him in trouble, but he was still alive to see Baudelaire to make his notorious and calculated break with decorum by the publication in 1857 of his collected poems, Flowers of Evil. Baudelaire's poem, Carry On, sounds like something from Salvador Dali. Quote, flies swarmed over the putrid belly from which emerged black battalions of maggots, which flowed like a thick liquid along those human rags. That's well before the scandal of surrealism. That was radical what Baudelaire did there.
Yes, it's very difficult to get inside Baudelaire's head. I have tried, but...
you just need to take some more drugs there, Dennis.
Well, I mean, he smoked hashish for a bit, famously.
Yeah.
But he wrote a tract about drugs. Basically, he said, don't take drugs because it'll spoil your poetry. Don't think that drugs are going to help you. They're not. So he wrote against drugs in the end, an essay.
Would he be writing against cocaine or something, or opium rather than hashish?
There might be opium as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe he said he noticed it affected his own writing.
It's not clear to me how much of those drugs he did take, The impression I've always had that he wasn't grossly involved with drugs.
Okay. So I hadn't thought this before, Flowers of Evil could refer to the content of his poetry. He was pushing the imagistic rules. That's what he meant. He was creating flowers of evil.
Yes, of course.
Like, what were the flowers of evil?
Well, they were his poems, of course.
Okay, so he purposely was provoking people. He's like a porn publisher and making these ugly images that violated the rules of decorum in art.
Yes, he's writing at a time when other poets were still using Alexandrines in couplets and so on, the traditional poetry of France. But he was among those who began to break out of that restriction, obviously.
Right, well, we'll get that to the influence on the world of painting that he has later. But we're doing with the five rules of painting of haute picture poesis, which rule for about 200 years. Yeah, 200 years of these rules are holding forth.
Except, of course, that they don't hold up, for instance, if you paint a landscape. They don't hold up if you do a still life.
Loads of the lower kinds of painting.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. They're way down.
Okay, the fifth rule is called expression. The final precept in the doctrine of haute picture poesis concerned expression, a matter closely linked to decorum. In its earliest form, expression was a matter of getting right the gestures and facial emotions in the painted image so that viewers might read, according to Leonardo, whatever emotion was in the mind of the person portrayed. According to later theorists, if this was well done, viewers might even experience those emotions themselves through an assumed sympathetic faculty, something that psychology later has to some degree confirmed, pointing out if you contort your face to look sad, you can actually find yourself feeling sad. However, in artistic practice, it is not so easy. Alberti was the first to see this, where in his book Della Pittura, he had discussed the problems that arise in depicting emotions. Quote, he says, "Think how if you try to paint a laughing face, it can come out as a weeping face, a most indecorous result." Leonardo da Vinci seems to have thought this could be resolved by more stringent empirical observation, but in spite of his contribution, the problem remained. It was so pressing 200 years later that the first president of the French Academy, Charles Le Brun, following Descartes' The Passions of the Soul, written in 1649, published 1649, he created in 1702 an illustrated text for his students called How to Learn to Draw the Passions. And this ruled until, well, Darwin settled the debate. Do you want to explain the Fuller-Pollock debate?
Griselda Pollock is a notorious left-wing art historian and feminist historian who taught at the University of Leeds for a time, which is an institution that has given accommodation to left-wing art historians. And Peter Fuller was the editor of a journal called Modern Painters. Somehow or other they came together, and these left-wingers were hostile to Peter Fuller, who was very much a conservative when it came to painting. He didn't like all those people on the left who said that a good painting has to say something on behalf of the people and the revolution, if you like, has to be tendentious. This comes from Walter Benjamin, whose essays were like a Bible to many of the left-wingers.
What's his name? I didn't get it. Oh, Benjamin, yes.
Walter Benjamin.
The famous mechanical art of reproduction or something. You're saying that essay, or he did others? That there was the Bible for the left.
Well, he takes the view somewhere in one of his essays that unless a work of art is tendentious, which is to say, unless it's got something to preach to you, it's not a work of art at all.
Wow.
Now, I don't know whether Griselda Pollock went that far, but I'm sure she would have appreciated most those women artists, for instance, who wrote on behalf of feminism.
So how does this relate to the problem of gesture and expression? Facial expression.
They are arguing about it. In a way, she has a more sophisticated argument than Peter Fuller. We remember that the group of the Laocoon, which is created sometime in the first century BC, had been discovered at some point during the Baroque period and been cleaned up and had a few patches put on it, and shows you Laocoon and his two sons who are being strangled by serpents that have come from the sea because he attempted to betray the Trojan horse to the Greeks. So they come up and they are strangling him. What I say about this and the argument between these two people, these two modern people, except, of course, I think she's still alive, but Fuller died in a road accident about 25 years ago and a very young man. Mm. You quoted what Alberti said about painting a laughing face and how you have to be careful because it can come out as a weeping face. The problem remained so pressing 200 years later that the first president of the French Academy, Charles Le Bon, attempted the so-called anatomy of the passions based on Descartes' theory about the pineal gland, and you did mention that, I think,
yes,
which aimed at communicating the emotions directly. At first glance, the schemas in this book are astonishing. Rage really seems to communicate rage. But then you ask, why is he labeling the drawings if his theory works? The fact is, he had unwittingly devised a code with its key in the form of his book, and unmediated communication was as far away as ever. Because what he's talking about is that you don't need to be told anything. You can see it's there. You're a human being. You know what human beings look like when they're angry, when they're shocked, when they're
being strangled by snakes.
Yes. When you look at those drawings and you see the caption underneath, you can believe that. But if you're shown the drawings without the captions and asked to put the captions in out of a box or something, you're going to have more trouble. In any case, I then quote, when the editor of the journal Modern Painters, Peter Fuller, he was late Peter Fuller when I wrote this essay, referring to the classical sculpture of Laocoon and his sons being strangled by serpents, asked historian Griselda Pollock, how do we know that Laocoon is supposed to be in pain? And she replied, because we have studied the mode of production prevailing in Greece at the time. I'm not even sure that this was a Greco, it's maybe more like a Greco-Roman statue than a Grecian statue, but anyway, studied the mode of production prevailing in Greece at the time and the signifying practice to which it gave rise. But, said Fuller, Laocoon is being strangled by a sea monster. And her response was, yes, but just by looking at the sculpture, we have no way of knowing he is not enjoying it. Fuller seemed to think that she had thereby reduced her case to absurdity. But of course, and this is me speaking now,
yeah,
but of course she had not. Experimental psychology has shown us that although visual forms may be expressive, it helps to have cues to tell us what they are expressive of, tears of joy or tears of sorrow. I'm reminded of an experience I had years ago when glancing at a muted television. This was somewhere around 1964, I think, 65. I saw a crowd of obviously Arabic people waving white scarves and dancing in what appeared to be a jubilant parade until I turned up the sound and learned that they were people from the village where President Sadat of Egypt had been born who were mourning his assassination in a fashion customary to Egypt. I added to that little paragraph, I should have remembered my Alberti.
Right, well, that wouldn't have been 96, that was 1981. October 6, 1981 is when Sadat was murdered.
Oh, well, then it would have been 81.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you also point out that in the argument, Pollock gets support from Charles Darwin, who wrote The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animal, some other book.
Uh-huh.
And it was written after his monumental Origin of Species. This book, the result of 25 years of research using all the empirical methods available, determined that although there are gestures and facial expressions that are universally interpreted without the mediation of words, there are others that do need a verbal label. So that's what we're saying, that this labeling, that's Pollock's point, right?
Yes, and I think there's much to be said for it. As I said, when I removed the labels from Lebrun's drawings.
Right.
Just
But the point, this all is within the fifth rule of expression, and the rule was you got to know what you're doing when you're dealing with the gestures and the faces. And
of course, what has happened since, though, and it happens around the time of Van Gogh, as everybody calls, but Van Gogh, as the Dutch call him, when he decides that the way he is painting following the Impressionists maybe could express his own psychic feelings rather than the psychic feelings of the people that he's portraying or the rooms that he's portraying, because he reckons, of course, well, if that's correct, you don't need a person to be weeping or to be going through agonies of psychological trauma. All you need to do is paint a room. And if you paint it like I paint it, you'll know I'm going through a psychological trauma.
That was the end of Rule 5?
That, I think, comes to the end of Rule 5, because expressionism is derived from Van Gogh. That's another matter altogether. It's a breach of decorum as well as being a breach of the old notion of expression of individuals within the painting.
Just to finish this point, you say in your essay, needless to say, the various connotations of expression resonate through all the arts and remind us of just how much expression and painting owe to expression in the theater, the pulpit, and even the courtroom, venues where the performer's whole body was often kinetically involved. So Le Brun was by no means alone in writing as he did, and just as he concentrated on the human face, so his contemporaries in the theater examined what the various inflections of the hands and even the fingers were supposed to communicate through unmediated expression, which, like him, still labeling each one. They were labeling it. It really was technical, the way one performed in theater.
Just now, that of course in the theater you get a lot of cues about what emotions are being expressed, don't you?
Yes. But they still felt they had to make rules about it.
Well, we're talking about the accepted conventions of the theater in the 19th century, I guess, when we say that, right?
Yeah, or the 18th century.
After that. I mean, all through, it's not difficult in certain circumstances to see that there must be some anguish or some hilarity or something.
We've covered the five rules. For 200 years, they were instruction and delight, imitation of classical models, invention, decorum, and expression. So That's the way the painting world was, with a little digressions in the Rococo period. But basically, until you get to the French Revolution and the industrial era, everything's going along okay. It's pretty controlled. But then it starts to wane after Louis XIV by Watteau and Boucher's divertissement theory in the Rococo period. Basically, you've got a bourgeois moralist reaction against the aristocrats after Watteau's hedonism style takes over. Is that what we're saying here?
Yes.
After the rules are thrown out, then this hedonism and erotic indulgence comes in, and I guess all kinds of artists start following that trend. And then around the time of the French Revolution, there's a bourgeois reaction, a puritanism, a moralist reaction, and they have to start painting republican themes. So we would move to what you call the grand manner.
I think the grand manner comes to an end with the French Revolution.
Right.
Because it's used for the portraits of the great, so to speak.
So in the higher level of paintings, the paintings of the kings and the aristocrats, this phase during the 200-year period, you have something called the grand manner, and then the idea of inspired genius starts coming in, and you lay out the argument between the Poussinistes and the Rubenistes. That's those around Le Brun's support of Poussin. And they were the finishers. And then the Rubens were the types of painters, modeled after Rubens, were the sketchers. You make a really important point here between the executive phase of painting and the generative phase. Now, that's a lot of concepts. Is there anything that comes to mind you want to talk about, you know, just verbally here before maybe we go into some of the details? What is your point about the grand manner and inspired genius? What has to be pointed out in leading into the concept of the artist?
The idea comes from people who are watching artists, people who consider themselves historians or critics or whatever. The people who began to talk about this were those people. For instance, there's a German called Winckelmann, Johann Winckelmann, and he set out to write a history of ancient art. That was published in 1764. When he did that, he tried to separate out what was Roman from what was Grecian, and he claimed to have been able to do it because he could read what he called the Zeitgeist, which means the spirit of the time. Now, he wasn't particularly successful in the long run, according to most of the individuals who checked him out 100 years later. But at that time, his claim was very convincing to a lot of people. So this notion that you could tell something about the atmosphere of the entire nation, in a way, if you could read a work of art well, if you were a good historian, if you could compare it with earlier works of art and translate the work itself into something like what he calls the time spirit. The time spirit is something that becomes very popular after that, just as you get the spirit of a people, too. This word spirit in the 19th century, particularly because the philosopher Hegel took it up, slightly different way, perhaps, but it's there.
So Winckelmann says that the artist is somehow in touch with the spirit of the times. This is you.
That's it, and you can see that, and you can distinguish between the Roman and the Grecian by your perspicuity in seeing it. But one of the things he says is, and this I'm quoting from a translation of his, he says some of that can be seen, and he makes a comparison with grape juice and wine. He says, for as the first gush of grape juice from the press forms the finest wine, so in the soft material and on paper, the genius of the artist is seen in its utmost purity and truth, whilst on the contrary, it is concealed beneath the industry and polish required in a finished painting and a completed statue. The same kind of thing was said for sculptors who made clay models as well, that the clay models had more life, so to speak, in them, whatever one might call life, than the finished job. In any case, the quarrel between the Poussinist and the Rubenist is that Rubens paintings were, well, you might say, if you understand Winckelmann, Rubens was more responsive to his time. The works that he made show a whole different sensibility from the works Poussin was making around the same time.
You make the point, Dennis, that the wine juice is at the beginning, so the sketch is indicative of the genius and picking up the spirit of time more than the finished painting. And the Poussinists represented the expertise of the final polish. Yet the intuitive school or the impulsive school or whatever, the initial inspiration sided with Rubens. And this becomes a really important debate.
Because when you see a Rubens painting, it is sketchy, there's no question. Now, it isn't perhaps as sketchy as the sketches he made before he did it, but he's very generous. You can follow his brush marks and so on. He's not afraid of that. If you stand far enough back from the painting, and this was something that we bring up again when we talk of musicality, because it was what Delacroix saw in Rubens. If you stand far enough back so that you can't even tell what the painting's about, it still has presence because you can see the color and call it a musical parallel. In short, it's abstract painting, although that was not a word used at the time.
We're talking about where the idea of the artist, who are dropping the notion of the artist as a lowly craftsman. For 200 years, he's an educated craftsman. But the idea that he has anything to do with the people or zeitgeist or genius is just now coming in because of the debate between Poussinists and the Rubenists. That's your point you make in your article.
As anyone who's read the whole of the piece will know, it was the Rubensists who won, to a large extent anyway.
Let me add to this, there were two other categories. The Rubenists, they do generative paintings, or the phase, the beginning of the sketch is the inspiration, whereas the Poussinists are the executive. They emphasize the executive phase, which is the final polishing and completing. So you have this other dialect between the generative phase, That's the Rubenese and the Poussinese, the executive phase.
Of course, everybody was supposed to do both phases, but there's enough difference between those two artists that you can separate them out. They're artists both from roughly the same period, and they're both very different.
Yeah, now this is going to get into the issue of salons, which we'll get to in a minute, but I want to read this. You write, Delacroix's Death of Sardanapalus was not only condemned for lack of decorum, but also for his failure to distinguish a painting from a sketch.
Yes.
You wrote, though his critics were to moderate their language later as the tide began to turn in favor of the sketchers. And how it turns is really interesting. Why do the Rubenese win? Well, you've got the annual competition for the Rome Prize, which has been going on for many years when you get into the 1850s and 1860s. But to enter the contest, you had to submit a sketch of what you were going to submit later in the polished painting.
Yes, you had a fenced-off little place to go to do the painting. And amazingly, you were supposed to complete the sketch in one day, and then it would be taken away from you, and you were supposed to do the finished painting in the next few weeks without seeing the sketch again, which was an incredible kind of stress, I would think, on anybody. What ensued was that students began to practice the sketch at the expense of finish.
Yeah.
So you got sketchier works that were finally entered into the competition appeared increasingly sketchy as a result, because unless you have a lot of practice in finishing, using all the techniques that are standard for finishing paintings, like scumbling and glazing and goodness knows what, to meld all the brush marks together and not to see, you know, it's a bit like spraying your car. You have to go back again and back again to get an overall undifferentiated surface, don't you?
Yes.
But to do that on a painting which requires lights and darks and everything else, you use these other techniques. But if you can't use them, and they are very delicate and problematic, well, you have to submit works that are sketchier. And that's what began to happen. And you might say that this sort of quarrel, which is sometimes called the difference between the ancients and moderns as well, ended as the 19th century began with the increasing, how can we put this, that a lot of people continued faute de mieux to paint sketchy paintings. There was not only Rubens and the Baroque, there were other artists in the Baroque who painted in the same manner as Rubens, but there was also a lot of artists in the Rococo who painted what we might call at least sketchier paintings than had been the case before. So as the 19th century grows, so do the numbers of people who accept this technique, and you get a situation in which the academies, which were important to artists, because to be able to show in the academy meant that you would probably get some sales, you'd get some prestige, your work might be bought. So it was necessary to get into the exhibitions, and the people running the selection committees were generally people on the side of the finishers. So sketchy works were rejected. There are a number of incidents. For instance, Napoleon showed the rejects from one of the academies, and there were two or three others. But in 1863, there was a famous event in which about 4,000 paintings were rejected by the selection committee, and a great row started. And Louis Napoleon, the then emperor of France, and he'd been emperor then for, 12 or 13, 14 years, he was greatly in need, really, of placating disturbances of this kind. So he opened part of the Palace of the Louvre for the rejects. And you had a famous event in which these rejected paintings were all shown. And people went there either to laugh at them or not, but they were shown. And the critics went, and the atmosphere by 1863 was, I mean, if you remember at the beginning, we mentioned that when Baudelaire wrote his Paris Salon, it was in 1846. So the critical mass had increased enormously. newspapers, printing presses, all kinds of things were humming along by 1863. So there was a sense that everything was changing.
And even Napoleon the Emperor had to sort of listen to the people.
And of course he had been something of a tyrant at the beginning of his reign. But I think it's genuine to say that as the time wore on towards 1870, when the war with Germany became a disaster for him.
Yeah, the Franco-Prussian War.
Yes. Until that time, he was certainly planning to ease up on some of the restrictions he had placed on the, mostly on the Paris people, because everything happened in Paris. Nobody gave a damn, you know, what happened in Lyon or somewhere.
Right. This is what Walter Benjamin writes about, his famous exploration of this change in Paris. It's a major work that Benjamin left in the 30s.
Yes.
It was about this period. That's where he, the left would say, discovered the medium was the message. You know what I mean? That's where he becomes McLuhan-esque, or they can cite him as an antidote to McLuhanism. That's what the left does. When Hannah Arendt publishes Illuminations in 1968, celebrating Benjamin's The Art of Mechanical Reproduction and those essays, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, that is a result of his analysis of what the great architect did to the redesign of Paris with the boulevards. Okay, so that's a side thing. It just shows you that the tremendous industrial effects are happening at the time of this old-fashioned emperor. What's interesting, out of this salon of 1863, the Salon des Refusés, the refusers, there's many artists, Manet, Cézanne, Jonquin, Braquemont, Pissarro, but Fanton Latour, Le Gros, and Whistler, all admirers of Delacroix, were to found the first explicitly avant-garde group of painters, the Société des Trois. We shall be the front runners," wrote Le Gros to Whistler. So that's pretty important, right? We're talking about how the artist becomes the creative genius.
I think this is terribly important to say and emphasize, because in the last 20, 30 years, we've had a lot of left-wing critics and historians distort the whole notion of what it means to be avant-garde. And clearly, when you write as that was written, you're talking about something that can be called the avant-garde. We're going to be the forerunners. We're in front. Everyone's going to be following us. I mean, that's what he means. He's got evidence of this because he's seen, for instance, the Impressionists and everybody following them already. A young German literary critic wrote a book about the avant-garde. His name was Peter Berger. He claims that the avant-garde was, so to speak, a sort of left-wing mix of rebellion and anarchism, and that it begins with the Dada group. Somewhere just after the First World War. That's a complete distortion of the notion of avant-garde. I have, for instance, in my apartment, I have a poster. I'm not sure whether you'd call it a poster. Perhaps you'd call it a theater program by Toulouse-Lautrec. What is the date? I think it's still a 19th century drawing of Lautrec's. Yes, it's the 1898 season of the Théâtre Antoine. He is advertising two plays. He's just saying that it is the soirée d'avant-garde de 5 novembre. So it's an avant-garde evening in the theatre, and the date is 1898.
So there's the use of the word before...
Yes, there it's up in print on a poster. So this use of the word avant-garde has been corrupted in this most extraordinary way by this guy, Peter Berger, who actually talks about the first examples of it. If you know the Dada style, you know that quite a bit of it had to do with collage and sticking bits of photo or something.
Assemblage.
You could call it assemblage if you want. He points back to Picasso's use of it as being the first use, which is fair enough. He speaks of Picasso's famous painting, small painting, called Still Life with Chair Caning. If you look at it, what you see is a picture with a piece of oilcloth embossed to look like chair caning. It's the kind of thing that you might have found in a cheap pub covering the wooden table. It does look like caning. It's still being used today in certain chairs that you can buy in specialty furniture shops. But in this case, it wasn't real caning done by hand with real cane. This stuff was just a piece of embossed oilcloth stuck onto the picture. But he doesn't say that. He says when Picasso glued a piece of wicker basket to his painting. So he hadn't even seen the painting. And yet, everyone will tell you, Peter Berger, he's the guy.
Does October the Journal follow Berger? Are they Bergerites?
Oh, yes, I would say they were, yes. I would think they wouldn't quarrel with each other if one of them said, well, Peter Berger did this or that. Yes,
right,
absolutely.
And that has been a very influential journal in the art critical world, right? October.
Yes, it's highly intellectual. I'm not sure how influential it's been. I would say that it's a journal, a sort of art critical journal, that's probably published more erudite pieces in the last 25 years or so than any other journal of its kind, yes.
The point is we now have established the idea that there's an artist who's in touch with the zeitgeist, and he's inspired, and his inspiration comes out in the first moments of inspiration in the muse. This part of your article ends with this statement. Because Napoleon III really got in a lot of trouble after the 1863 scandal, the protests that followed this massive rejection of the 4,000 sketchers were so vociferous that they persuaded Napoleon III not only to decree that the refused painting should have a show of their own, but also to decree that instruction at the École des Beaux-Arts, with its insistence on finish, had suppressed the creative genius of students, and that the Academy would therefore lose its control of the teaching there. Now, that's radical, right? They had a coup there.
Yes, absolutely.
It's like the SDS taking over Columbia University in 68 and winning.
Yes. And of course, you can see, too, there had been in the arts, in poetry and literature, quite a lot of hostility towards him. He'd had to suppress it. So now he's doing him a good turn, because these are the rebels. These are the people who, on the whole, join in with the riots and so on that from now and then stirred up in Paris against him. So he's obviously got a political reason for doing this rather than an aesthetic one.
And then he really gets in trouble in 1870-71 when the Paris Commune happens after the French loss in the Franco-Prussian War. That's where these protests really get going.
Well, he has to escape to Britain, and where he dies 2 or 3 years later. If I'm sitting with left-wing friends and say, I don't know about Louis Napoleon, I mean, they'd all say, oh, come on, you know, you're an old fascist or something. Some people identify him with early fascism.
Right.
But the fact is that the situation in France, it was one of great unease. When he was elected, as he was, democratically, he decided that he needed to take over the place to run it and to get something done. Mm. I mean, his huge modification of Paris, I think, was a huge achievement. A lot of people want to put it down and say, well, yes, you know, he crushed the homes of 10,000 poor people in order to run a boulevard through the area.
He was the Robert Moses of Paris. He's the guy who destroyed New York City in the 1560s with the highways coming through Manhattan.
Oh, yes.
Here we're talking about Louis Napoleon III as the Robert Moses of Paris, you know, 100 years before.
Yes, I mean, what my left-wing friends say is, well, you know, he made these boulevards straight so that if there was another insurrection, the troops could move at breakneck speed across Paris.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what Dick Gregory used to say in the 70s, that the superhighways of the United States in the 50s were built for Pentagon reasons, for the military to move troops through America if the big wars started to happen, or a national emergency and fascism or totalitarianism. That was all a military operation, these highways.
That was certainly the case in Germany with the Autobahn. Yeah.
Okay, well, here's what you write. You say, so the decree of 1863 by Louis Napoleon III may thus be said to mark the triumph of the Skechers. Now, it's so controversial, this whole debate, been going on for like 100 years. You say, not surprisingly, Ingres, how do you say I-N-G-R-E-S?
Yes,
who had himself boycotted the Salon for the preceding 30 years, he called the decree, quote, the destructive language of Romanticism, which expects to know everything without an effort to learn anything. He couldn't even take the radicals.
It's lovely that, isn't it? I love that quote from him.
Yeah, he's a radical himself, but they're going too far.
Yes, he's a radical who had boycotted the Salon, never entered for it.
Okay, so you've described how Van Gogh ended the fifth law of expression. A sentence here you have, instead, expression could be extended to the painters themselves through the colors and marks on the picture surface, colors and marks which by their lurid nature and agitated handling in paintings by Van Gogh, Munch, Vlaminck, or Nolde could supposedly transmit the painter's own exacerbated emotional states. So this is where the psychology of the painter and the genius is coming in. This is how it happens. What the modern understanding of art, at least for the last 100 years, is due to the battles at the Salon, you know, which is very interesting to think. It's not about the data. It's not about a bunch of anarchists in World War I. It's a whole technical environment of controlled academic instruction that's leading to the avant-garde.
Yes, absolutely.
Another phase happening similarly, or parallel to this Salon crisis, is the new nationalism, which you touched on. So just to move along and review it, I'll just read what you wrote to sum it up. It is no accident that expressionism as a movement became fashionable, just as the Nordic Teutonic countries of Europe were creating new national identities. The next sentence, Germany was unified in 1871. The composer Sibelius completed his Finlandia suite in 1899, just prior to the independence of Finland, and Munch's Norway separated from Sweden in 1907. And you write, it is no surprise that an important part of the nationalist agendas of these countries was to disengage from the, quote, cultural imperialism of classical Greece, Rome, and the Italian Renaissance as enshrined in the doctrine of U pictura poesis, and to replace it with the more emotional heritage of the Gothic, seen by the young German writer Goethe as early as the 1770s as the true German art. This cultural reversal, warranted perhaps by what we now call, quote, seasonal affective disorder, common in the countries of Northern Europe, followed from theories of cultural relativism set afoot by the significantly styled German Sturm und Stress, Sturm und Drang, of the late 18th century to which Goethe had belonged. Theories that were later condensed into the snappy catchphrase, race, milieu, and moment. What's moment?
Just the time, you know, just the fact that it's race, milieu, I mean, race for me would be white European or whatever white people are called. Race, milieu would mean I'm a middle class entrepreneur with a few paintings to sell or something. And moment is 2013.
Moment is like now?
Yes, it's the moment when the work is made.
So it's about now. This is part of this national trend. Race, million, moment.
What it means is those are the three principal sources of one's inspiration, if you like, that you live in the 20th century, that you...
The zeitgeist. You're expressing them at the time.
That's right.
The period.
The new way of talking about the zeitgeist.
And this phrase, race, million, moment, was coined by the French theorist Hippolyte Taine, T-A-I-N-E, a professor of art history and aesthetics at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris from 1863. And it applied to all the arts. The Swedish novelist Per Lagerkvist, writing, quote, anguish, anguish is my heritage, as the epigraph to all his books. That is not something Rabelais would write.
Yeah.
200 years before. Baudelaire himself seems to have failed to see the approach of this cultural tsunami, even though he had noted the contrast between northern and southern temperaments in his Salon of 1846. His dandyism seems to have persuaded him that the determinants of style were the rather insipid l'époque, la mode, la morale, and la passion. And you have down in your notes the translation of that. Those four aspects are, let's see, Baudelaire said, beauty is a divine ghetto around which the period, its fashion, its morale, and its passion form a titillating crest to the eternal element inside. And that's what that phrase, l'époque, la mode, whatever the other one was, that's what the translations are.
I think Taine is much more sensible. He was much less given to the kind of thing Baudelaire wrote. I mean, there's something about it's a divine piece of ice cake or something. I mean, come
yeah.
on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not the way Taine could have written, but it's certainly the way in which Baudelaire would write.
But Baudelaire missed this larger national tribalism that starts happening.
Yes, I think so.
The next point, I call it this in my notes, the meeting becomes the message. And what this is, Alberti's transparent glass metaphor is reversed 400 years later by Whistler's, quote, opacity of the canvas surface metaphor. Whistler was the first to pour paint on a horizontal canvas. Okay, so we'll take a break, and this will be part two. We will start to move into the heyday of the genius. We'll do that in our next conversation. So I hope we've shown that this is a pretty important article you've written.
We have been talking about the old paradigms of painting and that we're now moving out of the old ones and discussing some of the more recent ones. What I did was move from the Plotinus and people at the end of the Quattrocento because nothing had happened about the noumenal until we come to Baudelaire's poem Correspondance.
And then we get to the symbolists, and they retrieve Neoplatonism.
Yes, the whole of the symbolist movement.
Yeah, yeah. Through theosophy. So we've been doing part two with Dennis Young. We're not finished, and we will continue our next opportunity to do part three. But I hope you've enjoyed learning all the stuff that Dennis taught and has a unique perspective on the history of art. So that's it for today. Thank you very much.